Note to self, edit that out in the final version. Starting again. Vampires pee.
This is the Extra Hawk Right Podcast, episode 618 for the week of June 8th, 2026. I am low flow blood urinal David T. Cole, and I'm here with telepathic heckle Sarah D. Bunting.
Your song sucks.
Groupie slash snack Tara Ariano.
I just had Sour Patch Kids.
And aspiring cool guy bassist Caroline Franke.
Welcome to Extra Hot Great for another week. Joining us, she is a writer you have heard with us before, but it has been a minute. It's Caroline Framke.
Welcome back,
Caroline.
Hi. Thank you so much. Hi.
We're thrilled to have you to talk about Interview with a Vampire Season 3. After the first two seasons brought us from the 1910s to the years after World War II with a whole bunch of flashbacks to centuries before all of those things, we're mostly in the present day of the interview frame story. Now Lestat, Sam Reed, is the frontman of a band called The Vampire Lestat, touring smallish theaters by bus. The act is attracting goth fans who've imprinted on Daniel Malloy's book, Interview with a Vampire. Daniel Malloy, of course, played by Eric Bogosian. Daniel is also on the tour making a documentary about Lestat, financed by shadowy backers who have a special interest in what he's up to. But even as Lestat takes the stage as the most confident rock god who's ever not lived, he can't escape painful memories and figures from his past, some of whom join him in the present. The show is adapted by Roland Jones from Anne Rice's series of novels. The first episode of season 3 aired on AMC June 7th. We got access to the first 6 episodes of 7 in the season, but we will be careful about spoilers from future episodes. Let's do the Chen check-in. Caroline, should our listeners watch Interview with a Vampire season 3?
Oui.
Sarah.
Yes. Freebird. Yes.
Dave.
I enjoyed it.
I did as well. Good show. Let's get into it. Season 2, which I thought I liked okay, kept Lestat largely off screen. And when the season 3 credits started, I realized how glad I was that he is front and center again. Caroline, did you also feel a big spike in the energy for season 3?
Yeah, and I think because I really like the show Interview with the Vampire. I really like the first two seasons. But I think my biggest hesitation with it, the thing that kept me from loving it completely, is that I found the interview itself pretty tough.
Yeah.
Because Louis in the present day did not have the sense of humor Louis had in the past. You didn't get Lestat, as you said. But it just was dreary, and there was no, you know, Armand is intense. Armand has no sense of humor. Mm-hmm. And there's only so much snarky journalist stuff I can take before I'm like, we get it. You're the only one kind of pinging off here. So to get Lestat back in the flesh, not through recollection, is really interesting and fun. But also to have him doing the interview, I'm very happy that he's now a part of that aspect of the show, that part of the mechanic, which is so important to it. Even though it's not technically called Interview with the Vampire anymore, it still is.
It's one thing for a character to be written as a charismatic rock star. Translating that to the screen could be a huge letdown. I felt Sam Reed was pretty convincing. Sarah, what did you think?
I loved that he took all of the most like risible aspects of Mick Jagger, of Jim Morrison, especially. And then the key to the show is its utter confidence in its deranged ideas, whichever directions they're going. But it's understanding also that it is kind of deranged and operating at this frequency that's like, it's a lot. There is in the first episode this scripting equivalent of, I haven't seen anyone that I could actually talk to in like 2 weeks. Energy, just like a gust of references and timeline changes and stuff like that. But the show is utterly confident that this sort of druggy collage is going to work, and it does. And a big part of that is Sam Reed just buying in completely. Like, he never cheats it. He's always doing something. I bought it. It's really a lot of fun. And given how many sort of not that convincing portrayals we've seen of rock stars, of drug trips that think they're more interesting than they are, This was really quite a triumph, I thought.
Yeah, I agree. Lestat, I will also add, has to do a lot of suffering. So I like when the show lets Sam Reed be funny. like when Lestat has to deal with trick-or-treaters or bookstore clerks trying to get him to join an affinity program, or when he is playing his own body double. Dave, what did you think of the comedy moments that we get early on?
The body double. I enjoyed season one and season two, but this one, it's not a like total tonal change, but there's enough going on that's new to me that makes me feel like I don't know if I could go back and watch one and two now, having tasted the sweet fruit that is season three. Mm-hmm. And he is such a big part of that. I mean, they plant their flag in the soil pretty quick with the credit sequence, which, of course, is all new. It is all very sort of nouveau punk, you know, scratching out eyes and from magazine covers and all this sort of stuff. And they put one of their original songs there up front, and it's pretty catchy. And Sam Breed is singing it, right? That sounds like him.
Yes, he's doing his own singing.
Yeah, like we already know from the first couple seasons that he was very much into this. He loved the books. He very insistent on doing everything right. And it kind of shows in his performance that he is really steeped in what's going on here. But just that energy, that sort of rock star, anything goes, but also is a vampire tale, is really a great mix. The original takes place in the 80s. The original story of this?
I believe so, yes.
That's my only thing, is I kind of would have loved to seen all this, but on top of that, they look like poison or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, it seems more apropos to me. Like, there's something about a rock band touring in 2025 when this is set that feels muted compared to what it could have been if it was set in the 80s. Mm-hmm.
I thought the songs, I mean, you touched on this, Dave, felt legit. Mm-hmm. Daniel Hart is credited with writing the songs. He's been the show's composer all along. He's also scored most of David Lowery's movies, including Mother Mary this year, which is like basically what if Lady Gaga was haunted, also about a rock star. He co-wrote episode 5, and he's toured with the Polyphonic Spree, although when I read that, I was like, well, anyone could just say
everybody's that. Everybody's toured with the Polyphonic Spree. Yeah. Right? They're currently at 428 members.
Yes. Put it on your resume. No one is going to be able to fact check it. But anyway, what did you think of the songs, Caroline?
Oh, I thought the songs were fun. I did just watch the first episode. I thought I was going to watch more, and then I genuinely needed to sit in silence for like half an hour and absorb it and just didn't go back for a second, because it's really sensory overload, that first episode, in a way that I think, you know, is obviously meant to be like, this ain't season one, season two. We're in a new era now. And so I wanted to hear more of the words because, you know, afterwards there's always that little AMC has, now they're calling it Backstage Pass. Very cute. Mm-hmm. And one of the first songs he sings is about Lestat's first kill after his first kill, either, you know, first or maybe right after he sees Louis again. I forget which, but the words are meaningful. The words are on the nose, but they're also, you're getting a little bit a taste of Lestat unfiltered through the songs. But I just thought it was so fun to watch these scenes unfold in a way where I was like, I absolutely buy that Lestat would be this like demi rock god. This is so, it's a natural continuation of seeing him as a theater kid. And the other ones, like, this is a show about theater kids who become vampires and kill a lot of people. Everyone's very dramatic, him most of all. And I just bought it, like you said, I bought it completely, which it would not work if he were not as good at it. Some of the words of these songs are not great. The lyrics are fine. I think really it's much more about the vibe. It's about the charisma. But if I were to listen to the words and it were someone less charismatic singing them, it would take me out of it.
Yeah.
That didn't happen here. And also, Frank, you can tell this book was written in the 80s. It very much feels like, I think she's even said that Jim Morrison, and Rice said that Jim Morrison was her major inspiration for the vampire Lestat as rock guy.
Yeah, sure. No Jim.
There is an acknowledgement of that a little bit when they're in the tour bus and Malloy's like, well, Post Malone and Jelly Roll are playing to thousands of people in this amphitheater, and you're playing to 800 people in a little venue, and you have an ego. Doesn't that bother you? But to me, I'm like, I think it does bother him. Obviously, he wants more and more fans, as many fans as he can. But I also completely buy that a rock band like that would start gaining a cult following in venues like that. It actually just made me be like, oh, I miss concerts like that. Do they still exist? Can I find them? Like, because, you know, concerts have become, and this is set in a pandemic world. You know, this, a lot of shows we watch, COVID doesn't exist. It never did. But seasons one and two very much did, because that's when the interview was taking place, was during COVID. I'm not sorry to see that in the background, because it's always a lot to see that in TV. And I think we're not quite at a point where we can like really depict it. However, in post-pandemic world, concerts are a nightmare. Mm-hmm. Everyone's lost, like Broadway concerts, sports, like everyone's kind of lost their sense of, I feel, what it means to be in public with other people and that not all space is your personal space.
Yes.
And I miss concerts where, you know, this makes me also sound, you know, I'm very get off my lawn about please put down your phone during the concert. Just to, like, none of your videos are good. Mm-hmm. And no one was videoing Lestat during this concert. And I was like, that seems crazy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it was just fun to watch this concert. And I was like, even if I don't totally buy that this is taking place in 2025, there are aspects of it that they clearly thought about. And I just wanted to be at this concert.
Yeah.
Like, first and foremost.
I mean, if you're a vampire lead of a band, I think you would be tempted to mesmerize your audience to not pull their phones out of their pockets. So that could have been why.
True.
Mm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would.
That would take a lot of energy, too. We also get some of the new characters, members of the band, of course. Christine, the manager. I would have loved to see an episode from her POV.
Yeah, what does she think is happening here?
Right. And how hard is it to actually manage this situation?
And why is she friends with the Laurie Metcalf character from Hacks? And here's an exciting crossover.
Yes, true.
Oh my God, weed on the tour bus.
Mm-hmm. We've sort of touched on this already, but season three, far more, I would say, than season two, feels like new viewers could jump in here and then go back to season one and two to fill in the backstory if that's how they want to consume this. Dave, you're making a face.
I thought it was going to be that when it started, because when it started, it just threw you into the deep end of, okay, now we're a rock band and here we go. Mm-hmm. But then there were a lot more callbacks, a thing that have happened in the past, and they're jumping around a little bit more, playing with the timeline than I was expecting. And I think I would have been lost if I didn't know what was going on from season one and season two, which I haven't seen in a while. And even I had to, like, look a couple things up. One thing I'm curious about, though, has anybody read the book that this is based on?
No.
Nobody here? Mm. All right. Well, maybe somebody can tell me. I'm curious. There's a storyline. I think maybe they hint at it or start it in the first episode. But it's a storyline involving someone who looks a lot like Claudia, the vampire that was killed in season two. Mm-hmm. And it really feels like something they wrote for the show that might have not been in the books. You know, I'm always complaining about showrunners who can't let actors go, find some room for them. It kind of felt like that to me. So I'm curious if that storyline is in the actual novel. I would appreciate if somebody could let me know.
I do think there are going to be elements from the next book, which is Queen of the Damned, I believe.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I don't think they're planning on, you know, mashing those two books up. They're very different. But I think there will be elements from it. And I think I know who you're talking about. And if I'm not mistaken, and I might be, that might be part of that. So I think that might be a future call, not a callback. But I agree with you, Dave, that I think I was also expecting this to be a little bit more like a reboot, but it feels much more like a continuation than I thought. Tonally, it's very different. And the fact that we're in Lestat's point of view is obviously different. But there's so much history that they reference. And there's, I mean, even the fact that the first episode starts in the future, Lestat's not there, and we have to go back, and Lestat himself is jumping around everywhere. The timeline is crazy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very scattered, but it all draws on past stuff. I think, you know, something that's interesting about how this season has been marketed is that it's obviously being marketed very differently. More people know what the show is now. It's been on Netflix since the first two came out. I think there's a pretty strong group of diehard fans who are pretty upset that this season is getting more attention or more of a push when, you know, the first two seasons, which were from the perspective of the Black queer character, maybe didn't get the same amount of marketing attention or just attention in general. And I did miss Louis a lot in that first episode. I was happy to see that vampires can FaceTime in this universe. I wasn't sure if it was like mirrors and you don't show up.
Right.
Does anybody want a really definitive rule book for vampires in this show? Because I've always had hypotheticals I want to ask about, you know, vampire physiology.
I thought I did until we got the scene about peeing, which I really frankly did. That's the one I was like, okay, I don't need this one.
Okay, check, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I guess now we have a reason for if you see some sicko bringing their drink into the bathroom, like, oh, okay, it's a vampire, it's fine. I guess that's all right.
But like in previous seasons, we see if they eat actual food, they immediately throw up, and they throw up a lot.
I think that was what we do in the shadows.
Yeah.
No, was it?
Yes.
No. I thought it was here too. No?
I think they get sick, but I don't think we see how graphic it is.
My brain Swiss cheese, so that's fine. Okay. Well, let's pretend it was this show. No, I don't.
Sure.
There's a scene, I don't think it's in the first episode, but it's not really a spoiler, where they're served beer in order to make it palatable. They cut their fingers and put it in each other's beer so they can actually drink it. I thought that was the medicine that makes the beer go down. But apparently, it's a whole different show.
Yeah. I mean, I do like that Lestat. I mean, my favorite sequence from the premiere is Lestat reading the Interview with the Vampire book.
Yes.
And just furiously making notes and being like, that's not how it happened. It was raining. My hair was longer. Mm-hmm. And just, I thought Sam Reed was so funny in that scene. He wants to give his version of what the rules are.
Yes.
So that's where the peeing one comes in, I guess. But then he has that whole sequence about how he feels about sex and how he does not totally vibe with the description that was in the book as recounted by Malloy. And I thought that was really interesting. So maybe he has different rules. I don't know. It wouldn't surprise me. He's a maverick.
I think my favorite line from Lestat while he's narrating is, and this might be episode two, but again, if you know the book, actually, I'll just spoil it here. This is a spoiler from the books and the TV show, I'm going to guess. But there's a part where he's narrating and he just sort of like has this pause and then he speaks to the audience. You're being terribly patient with all the vampire incest. And he's like, I was like, that was really funny. He really actually made me laugh out loud. I am enjoying his narration of it as well.
Yeah.
And it also just feels fair enough to be like, you know, if we've been reminded over and over again by Malloy himself that he won two Pulitzers. Did you know he's won two Pulitzers? I just feel like maybe he, as a responsible journalist, should have gone to Lestat for comment if he was available. So I feel like it's fair enough that Lestat's like, actually, I do have some corrections on the record here.
Yeah.
Yes.
I just love that he not only knows who Joey Chestnut is, but thinks that he's extraordinary.
I lost my mind. I lost my mind at this reference.
So, I mean, because what a perfect cultural figure for Lestat to find.
So funny.
To be ensorcelled by, because all he does is feed. That's his job.
Yeah.
Like, okay.
This is a man who appreciates excess.
Yeah.
I truly.
Kindred spirits.
Yeah.
Write him in. Season four.
We get the briefest peek at Jennifer Ely at the end of the premiere. She gets a lot more to do in the rest of the season. Seeing her rampage through her scenes that are yet to come, I was so glad she managed to rest this part away from the ubiquitous Nicole Kidman, who it seems like was probably top of the list, but maybe was doing six other shows at the time and wasn't able to get in there. But she's great. That's all we'll say.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
She can get it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, always.
Maybe not with that accent, but.
There is an accent, yes.
Yeah.
We also hear about a menstrual product called Vampons, which is pretty good.
That's, yeah.
I loved all the texting and the Vampons. So it's just, I mean, it makes sense too that there are vampire groupies. There are vampire fans. That's, you know, that's a trope in so many vampire stories. We saw it in Buffy. You see it in so many things where there are people who believe in vampires who are absolutely going to be all in on this. So I think that's a really fun thing. And it's also, it makes sense that Lestat, who's a showman, would want to play to them. Mm-hmm. But it did make me go, you know, at the towards the end of the first episode, he is tripping balls on drunk blood, brings the vampirism out into the public in front of his bandmates, including, if I'm not mistaken, the lovely Patrick from Schitt's Creek, who's playing one of the guitarists.
Larry.
Mm-hmm. And then he flies off into the night and is like, whoops, I guess people know I'm a vampire and vampires exist now. And I'm like, this can't be the first time this has ever happened. So maybe future episodes address this, but I just, that's something that I feel like the show knows is a problem logistically, but it can't quite square. Like, come on, if vampires show up on camera, on FaceTime cameras and CCTV, this can't be the first time that's happened.
Real life vampire blooper reel would be great.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. I thought they did a good job with the idea that, like, sometimes the parody of the thing is the same as the thing. And I think other vampire properties have sort of tried to address the idea that, like, vampires can continue to exist because enough people believe in them, but also enough people don't, if that makes any sense. Like, the Buffy and Angel verse sort of tried to interface with this, but, like, network TV made it a little difficult to really go there. I think True Blood tried to talk about it, but, like, a lot of these properties also were extremely self-serious. couldn't quite find a way into talking about like the essential absurdity of like the only way I can get away with existing and not sort of being like, I don't know, canceled or killed is that enough people don't believe that this could be real and that this is actually like, I don't know, he's dehydrated and exhausted, quote unquote. I thought that the show was pretty clever about nodding at that idea, but not getting too in the sniffing its own vampire farts weeds. And if we find out about vamp fart strat,
oh my God.
I know Dave's in for unlimited seasons.
Those got to be rank.
Yeah. That's something I appreciate about Lestat. He's very why so serious, you know? And I feel like Armand's little theater group, I mean, Ben Daniels aside, was so serious. And he took his absurdist theater so seriously. And Lestat's like, we're fucking vampires. We're gods. Like, let's have fun.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I am very excited to see what else this season has.
I think vampire farts smell like copper.
Yep.
Yeah.
Oh, no, it's true.
Got a lot of shows. It's a great time for shows.
One last thought. I forgot. What did you guys think about the part where Lestat is pruning shrubs to make them look like vaginas?
Oh, Dave, that was also what we do in the show.
Darn it. All right, it is time for Around the Dial. First stop, as always, Tar.
I watched Not Suitable for Work. This is Mindy Kaling's new single cam sitcom on Hulu that was originally titled Murray Hill. It's all about cute 20-somethings in New York figuring out the first moments of their post-college working lives while living across the hall from each other. I'm confident the Friends echoes are intentional, but there are issues. First of all, there are five leads, three guys in one apartment and two girls across the hall. Hulu made it a 3-episode premiere. I watched them all. I think everyone here agrees I'm good at watching TV. At the end of these 3 episodes, I was confident about like 2 of the lead characters' names. I think it's because it's a single cam show and a rom-com and a workplace sitcom. It feels busy. Because in addition to the 5 leads, the premiere episode also establishes all their separate workplaces, bosses, colleagues, whatever sitcom problems they're experiencing there. You would think they would cut down on all that business by making one girl, played by Ella Hunt from Dickinson, and one guy, no idea of his name or story, co-workers. But then there's another guy, Kel, who's played by Nicholas DuVernay, who is Belinda's son in the last season of The White Lotus. He goes from med student to auditioning actor to high school substitute teacher in 3 episodes. I don't think I'm the only one who's not 100 on their names. In the 3rd episode, we see Kel with his mother. I'm pretty sure she calls him Ken. Another problem is the 2 leads who work together are investment bankers. So not only don't I care about whatever they do all day because it's boring, I'm prejudiced against them because it's probably also evil. Like there's truly a whole storyline about like, oh no, the charts were wrong. We have to run to the print shop before the meeting. I swear to God.
It's
this is not what I watch TV for.
What?
Yeah. Yet another problem is Josh, who is played by Jack Martin from La Brea, in which he also played a character named Josh. What he's trying to overcome is that A, his family's really rich because B, his father is the CEO of a TV network. So he's always trying to downplay his wealth and privilege right up to the moment that he needs to use them, like to leapfrog an intern who is expecting a promotion to PA by name dropping his father to the host of the news show he eventually gets hired on, who is played by Victor Garber. So it's not all bad. Seeing anyone succeed in media, even fictionally, is hard for me, but this character has such an uphill climb toward likability from where he starts. And every time they show any of the 20-something characters watching TV, by the way, it's not on TV. Kel watches the Colin Firth Pride and Prejudice on his laptop. Josh watches broadcast news. We're told it's his favorite movie on his phone. If this is actually how the youth are living, it is disgusting. Plus is one thing you can count on from a Mindy Kaling show is she will cast a lot of hot people. That is true here across all of the leads, their bosses, which include Jay Ellis from Insecure and Running Point. And in the case of the girl who is a stylist, don't know her character name. She gets a client who's played by Harry Richardson, getting to use his real Australian accent, unlike when he plays Bertha Russell's son, Larry, on The Gilded Age. The exception is the finance guy who really sticks out as like an 8 among all of the 10s around him. Like, sorry to this man whose name I don't know and will never learn. I also appreciate, I don't know exactly where it's going in terms of the rom-com story parts. When you see the series premieres of Friends or New Girl or Abbott Elementary, you know who all the eventual couples are going to be. Here, there seem to be multiple possibilities for all of the characters, so at least there was some effort taken to not be too predictable. Bottom line, the show's not very good. I will watch all of it. For my plug, I got to interview Kate O'Flynn from Widow's Bay, and I will link that in the show notes. She was delightful.
All right, Caroline, what do you got for us?
I unfortunately am bringing us to Fiji for Love Island season. It's June. It's hot. Hot 20-somethings want to make out all over Fiji. But I'm not recommending the current seasons that are unfolding in both for both the US and the UK. I have also decided to go back and fill in a reality show gap for myself, which is the fifth season of the UK Love Island, which is, per many of my reality show aficionado friends, seminal, important, etc. Mm-hmm. And there is something very interesting about watching a show that is so clear. It's meant to be watched in real time. The episodes are on most nights. It's shot almost in real time, which is a really unique aspect of it. It's very Big Brother. What is Love Island if not Big Brother with kissing challenges? Mm-hmm. But watching an old season, this one took place in 2019, I believe, is satisfying in its own way. I can throw on a couple episodes while I'm doing other stuff. If I'm brain dead at the end of the day, I can say, what are Curtis and Maura up to? Oh, more nonsense? Great. And then if I feel really bad about how someone's being treated, I can go and look them up and see if they're okay, as much as their Instagram presence tells me if they're okay mentally. A lot of currently quite big British personalities came out of this season of note. I mentioned is Maura Higgins, who was on the most recent season of The Traitors. She was a breakout there, and she is going to be on Dancing with the Stars in the fall. So clearly she's planning a stateside takeover, but this was her first thing. So it's interesting. It's always interesting to see where a reality person starts. And she was immediately a firecracker in a way that few of them were. But if watching 50 episodes of an old Love Island season doesn't appeal to you, I'd say fair enough. That's fair enough.
That's a lot.
We have but one life, unless you're the Vampire Lestat. And sure, if you'd rather spend some time with some more wholesome British people, I also do recommend Gardener's World, hosted by Monty Don. I believe it's available on BritBox here. It's an institution, a British institution. I spent some time in the UK as a kid, and my mom went to British boarding school. Many of my pop culture references tend British in this way, and Gardener's World has always been around in the ether, and it is just the most reliable little soothing shot of British white noise. I feel like I watch it like some people watch Bake Show. Mm-hmm. Right. I don't have a garden. I live in Brooklyn, New York. I can't even grow anything on my balcony. It does not work. It doesn't matter. I love seeing these gardens. If you are a gardener and you do have a yard, he has very practical advice that I am told is extremely useful.
And how many people is he hooking up with?
As far as I know, Montague Don is a stand-up wife guy, but he had a wild past, so.
No.
So that is lovely and on BritBox. But in the reality TV realm, I'll plug, I recently reported a feature for Bustle for their So You Want to Be on Reality TV package. And I interviewed a few producers, both present and former, about what it means to be a producer's favorite, what it can get you. Practical advice for anyone interested in the reality show Dark Arts.
If you had to pass along one piece of advice.
Honestly, everyone, it sounds corny, but be yourself. They cast you for a reason and stop self-editing. They can spot that a mile away, and it will be annoying to them in the actual edit bay if they have to edit around you constantly anticipating what you might look like on television. Be yourself, man. You've already signed up for reality TV.
Be yourself, the answer to everything. It's starting to annoy me, frankly.
It's really basic, but yeah.
All right, thank you. All right, Sarah D. Bunding, your turn.
I am here to talk about Michael Jackson, The Verdict. That's a three-part docuseries from Netflix. It came out last week. It could have been a feature, but is watchable, albeit difficult going, subject matter-wise, of course. It is narrowly about Michael Jackson's trial on child molestation charges in 2005, but more broadly, it is about how we civilians often have to hold great artist, wretched person ideas in our heads at the same time. The doc makes a point of including a full range of takes on Jackson's guilt. Reporter and case expert Diane Diamond is in it. Martin Bashir is in it. Jackson family attorney Brian Oxman is in it. They do not know this, but he has been disbarred for a while. Two jurors are in it. Former employees with varying degrees of commitment to the idea that he's innocent. A super fan who quit her job to attend the trial. She's in most of these documentaries. This could have been a performatively scrupulous attempt at fairness designed to head off interference by the Jackson estate, which approved the controversially uncontroversial Michael and also disappeared, leaving Neverland. But my take is actually that the doc wants to give viewers a 360 look at the time and the coverage and how the story felt as it was happening in the culture. Both things can be true. But that's sort of the larger meta aim of the series, I think, is, you know, two things can be true. Dealing with that is like part of growing up. I would have liked to see a more overt parallel drawn between contradictory but legitimate ideas coexisting within Michael Jackson, magnetic talent, traumatized man-child, predator, and contradictory but legitimate ideas coexisting in victims, Jackson's or otherwise. Victims, parents, dubious decision-making, or alleged grifts don't mean Jackson didn't also prey on their son. And you could say what you like about recent seasons of Law & Order SVU, and I've said most of it on this very podcast, but bless them for at least underlining this repeatedly, that victims can hold contradictory but both legitimate sets of feelings about their abusers. We understand this non-linearity of that kind of trauma better now than we did two decades ago. I think we can talk about it better. And I think the verdict would have benefited from making that point more pointedly, that this was perhaps a flaw in the prosecution's direct and cross-examinations and why they weren't able to achieve the verdict they wanted. There isn't really any new information here, and I have historically almost no use for testimony from the sort of crazy Jacko fan who rallies outside trials for people accused of touching children. But I think there's useful irony there in that not being able to let irreconcilable information coexist in your head or heart is in the end a childish thing. And Jackson buried himself in the symbology of Peter Pan, the boy who wouldn't grow up. And this documentary is sort of content to like step back and be like, and here are the gates of Neverland with the word Neverland on them. Think it over. We're moving on to this next thing. And look, I'm not sure all of this is even in the doc versus in this viewer and what she does for a living, but you can read my full review at Best Evidence. I will link it in the show notes, but bestevidence.fyi.
How about the time Lestat said bat and then he turned into a bat and flew away?
Dave, do you need to lie down?
I just realized I'm wearing my What We Do in the Shadows Arizona t-shirt, so maybe mm-hmm. that's what's affecting me.
Could be. They'd get along, Jackie Daytona and Lestat.
For sure.
I think they would.
Oh my God, 100.
Jackie Daytona on the bus, on the run.
Mm-hmm.
Gay is good, gay is in.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Here's what's coming up on Extra Extra Hot. Great in the week ahead. This Friday, we're going to be talking about HGTV's Crashers back in the reality show space with that one. Available to all club members. Go to extrahotgreat.com/club for more info and to sign up. And then come back here in 1 week's time. It is EHG Prime's look at the Hulu original movie, Never Change! Exclamation point. And we're welcoming back Brandy Brown for that one.
He doesn't like you. He's grumpy as can be. He doesn't like fun. That's plain to see. Time to ask, will Dave hate this?
Probably. I forgot who starts this. It's been so long since we've done this, but this is Will Dave Hate This, where we ask the question, will Dave hate this on an upcoming show? And this one is a doozy. Tara, you want to tell us what we're talking about?
Sure. They just announced a whole bunch of new shows coming to Canadian TV, including Mark Paul Gosselaar in a show called Bulges, which is, imagines a restaurant in Niagara Falls that's like Hooters, but for guys, where they're in crop tops and hot pants and... Apparently, Mark Paul Gosselaar went to the press event in his little shorty shorts to show off his bulge. God
fine.
Bless.
Fine.
We might be back in now, yeah.
What we're concerned about is a production from Seth Rogen and his producing partner, Evan Goldberg, which is a, let's say, remake of The Littlest Hobo, a show we have talked about on this show many times. As the Deadline article puts it, this will be a live-action drama reimagining of the classic Canadian TV series, which first aired in Canada in 1979, about an ownerless German shepherd dog who wanders from town to town helping people. So basically, the Incredible Hulk TV show, except it's a dog.
Did you see Caroline's face when you just explained the premise of the show?
No, I'm sorry.
It was a little taste of confusion.
this is real.
Just an amuse-bouche of bewilderment.
Yes. Our question today is, will Dave hate this? This is a show he has been obsessed with over the years, has brought different episodes to the table for us to discuss.
Yeah. So who is going to take the will Dave hate this? I think he will hate this position.
I believe that, Dave, you will hate this.
Okay.
As noted, this was a children's show. Dave is no longer a child in some ways. I just think it's no longer going to work for him, both because he is now an adult and because that aspirational, I want to know this dog hole has been filled by actual dogs that he can have as an adult. The creators are a weird fit for this material. They have said it was a foundational show for them as well, but I'm not sure their tone as adult creators and producers, not like, you know, adult film, but like grown-ups. I'm not sure that works for material like this. The real issue is that it was a foundational show for Dave, bad or not, warts and all. And I suspect there's going to be enough uncanniness to its various valleys now that the kidsiness will not cancel out. So I think even if it doesn't sink to the level of hatred, he is going to push back from this remake table after like two or three bites, because just buy the rights to the old one, guys. Sure. That's my pitch.
Okay, Tara.
It doesn't say they created it. It says they're producing it. So this just might mean it's being made through their production company. That said,
so there's a chance that it will not be basically the boys with the dog killing
people. Yeah, that's the thing. It's described as a live action drama, which means they're not going to like 21 Jump Street movie-anize it, which suggests, as far as we know at this moment, they respect the IP in its original form and vibe. And as part of the project, maybe Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg will remaster the original series and make it more widely available. This happens a lot when there's a remake. The original comes out. And perhaps Dave will embark upon a binge project. Sure. But, you know, one of us got to pick first, and it wasn't me. So that's the best I can do with why Dave won't hate this.
So you actually feel that he will hate it also?
Yeah. Mm. First of all, something nobody brought up, but it is a deal breaker if there's even a cover of the existing theme to Littlest Hobo. If it is not Maybe Tomorrow by Terry Bush as is, then I'm out. The other big thing, this speaks to Sarah's point, is that it is impossible to recapture the earnest magic from a wholesome 1970s TV show. You just can't do it this day without introducing a wink. Even if you're trying not to, it happens. Because there is an earnestness, there is an acceptance of all the goofy, wholesome shit that happens in 1971 to 1975 that you just can't produce these days. So I think the new show will be exactly what Sarah is saying. I will sample it. I will say you didn't do wrong by the original, but point people to the original. Watch this instead. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to say, for the sake of Sarah getting a win, Dave will hate this, even though it's probably going to be what she said. Dave will be okay with it and then forget it after three episodes. But it's not called Will Dave Forget About This After Three Episodes and Kind of Not Hate It. It's Will Dave Hate This?
It could be. It's up to you.
It is time for the Extra Hot Great Canon presenting this week, Dark.
Well, this is where we legally have to disclose that the canon segment has been sponsored by Gene Smart. From last week's Designing Women pitch to Friday's Hacks Tiny Cannon on Extra Extra Hot Great. We'll probably be done with her for a while after this, but maybe not. She has done a lot of great work. The many questions that Hacks explored in its run all stemmed from and revolved around its central relationship between veteran stand-up comic Deborah Vance, played by Smart, and comedy writer Ava Daniels, played by Hannah Einbinder. Ava is hired in the series premiere to help Deborah write some new material. From there, different situations force them to evolve through being sparring partners, one another's muse, opposing sides in a lawsuit, almost every kind of relationship two people can have. Almost. So let's talk about Season 5, Episode 7, Montecito. And here's why I think it's canon-worthy. Number one, it's got solid sitcom bones under its prestige TV trappings. The central problem of the final Hack season is a diabolically restrictive non-compete clause. While most of season four is about Deborah finally getting to live her dream by hosting a late-night network talk show, she blows up the opportunity rather than sell out her head writer, Ava. Deborah has not been permitted to utter words on any broadcast platform, so she's very focused on the sold-out Madison Square Garden show she's set to perform the first day she's legally allowed to do it. When Deborah has a dream in which she takes the mic completely nude to a crowd full of jeering copies of her hated sister Kathy, J. Smith Cameron, she doesn't interpret it as a classic stress dream about feeling unprepared for the show because she hasn't properly started writing it yet. She decides her subconscious is telling her to nail down her look and calls her psychic Diana, Polly Draper. Vague references from Diana to white slacks and sparkles up the wazoo convince Deborah she's supposed to wear the pantsuit Carol Burnett wore for the last episode of her sketch show. Ava offers to track it down online, clip one.
No need. All of Carol's looks were designed by Bob Mackie.
Shake.
Call Bob M.
Hello?
Bobby, it's Deb. Sorry for the cold call. I mean, you know how I'm doing the garden later this year? Yeah, I need a jumpsuit.
Deb, if I do something for you, I gotta do something for Cher. Then the next thing you know, Sabrina Carpenter is outside my door with a sewing machine and a gun.
I don't need a new design. Do you remember Carol's white look from her final episode?
Of course. I had it for years, but I donated it to a charity auction.
Do you remember who won it?
It was actually one of your fellow stand-up comics, but I shouldn't say who.
Rosie O'Donnell?
No.
Rita Rudner?
No.
Kelly Kilpatrick?
I couldn't say.
Oh, yeah, I heard. Kelly fucking Kilpatrick. That stupid bitch hates me. I've never known why.
You were pretty mean to her after she came out of the VMAs. I believe the exact quote was, she should go back into the closet and pick something else.
Okay, fine. Just, you know, it's probably where the weird energy started. We'll just have to win her over.
Abrasive loudmouth must humble herself to secure a favor would be a perfectly solid premise for a sitcom episode on its own, but when Deborah meets Kelly, Cherry Jones, in Deborah's apology booth at Spago, the story evolves. Clip two.
Deborah, so sorry to interrupt. I'm a huge fan. But someone left their phone in the car again.
I thought it was in my bag. Sorry, Kelly, this is Ava. Ava, Kelly.
Hi, nice to meet you. I'm sure you get this all the time, but when you guest starred as Lieutenant Lavandra Pax on Star Trek The Next Generation, it was like the first time I actually saw myself on screen.
Well, that's not the first time I've heard that, but I thank you.
Oh, my God, Deborah, is that coffee?
It's decaf.
Is it?
No.
You know if you have caffeine this late, you won't sleep. And if you don't sleep, I don't sleep. She has been having the worst nightmares. And then I wake up and I can't get back to sleep. And I get the night sweats anyway, but I've never been able to sleep completely nude. Because, you know, pajama pants give me really bad rash.
Honey, we're about to eat.
Sorry. Really nice to meet you.
What? I should have known. I am so sorry.
That's okay. For
no wonder you've been so bitter and frustrated and jealous all these years. It is so obvious.
What's so obvious?
That you're gay.
Okay.
Deb, I'm so sorry that I didn't realize sooner. And you know what? That's on me. Because it must have been so hard for you watching me live my truth out and proud.
Ava has spent most of the episode faintly bothered by having recently caught Deborah in a lie. Moments after Deborah said she couldn't pick Ava up from urgent care after a literal run-in with a Waymo because she was at Miraval in Arizona trying to poach its spa director for her new hotel, Meryl Marco called Ava and said she'd just seen Deborah driving to Beverly Hills and thought Ava might be in town with her. Since Ava's life is so intertwined with Deborah's that Ava's friends, correctly mostly, assume Deborah and Ava travel together, Ava thinks nothing of being invited along with Deborah to Kelly's place in Montecito for the weekend. It's not until they're standing in front of the house, having just finished bickering about this phone call, and are now waiting for Kelly and her Wonder Bread heiress wife Monica, Leslie Bibb, to answer the door, that the truth comes out. Clip three.
And I'm not being dishonest.
Okay.
Oh, by the way, Kelly Kilpatrick thinks I'm gay and you're my secret wife, so we have to spend the weekend pretending to be lesbian lovers so I can get that Carol Burnett jumpsuit.
What? Welcome, girls. Who's ready for a naughty little weekend?
Me!
Once Deborah and her putative trophy girlfriend have arrived in their guest suite, the two negotiate terms. Clip four.
I am not pretending to be a lesbian couple with you.
I need that jumpsuit. Please, it means a lot to me.
I guess it wouldn't be too bad to spend some time with the wife. Call me Chandler, because I'm going to fuck Monica.
You're my girlfriend. Do not flirt with her and blow up my spot. You and I are in a committed, loving relationship. You're sleeping in the tub.
I am not sleeping in the tub, okay? You know what? If you want me to do this, you got to give me $1,000. Yeah.
Deborah pulls out a wad of cash.
Oh, fuck, I should have asked for more.
Sorry. Forgot to say Negronis at 6.
Ah, thank you.
Hacks may be a very fancy, contemporary, award-winning show, but Two Goofs Must Sell an Outrageous Lie for Personal Gain is a sitcom episode premise just about as old as scripted comedy, and I mean that as a compliment. Number two, it gives the girlies, non-gender specific, what they want. This episode's premise wouldn't work if not for the fact that Hacks has been playing with the boundaries of Ava and Deborah's love story all along. When a pair of fictional people, one of whom, Ava, is canonically bisexual, fight as passionately as these two do, it's traditionally to set the groundwork for an enemies-to-lovers story arc. I don't claim to know everything about the queer Hacks fandom. I do know that two queer men, Guy Branum and Andrew Law, co-wrote it with Bridget Parker, whose alphabet I failed to confirm. I also know that if you search Hacks Ava Deborah on an archive of our own, you will find, as of this writing, 789 pieces of fan fiction about them, much of which I presume is horny. Is it as horny as this episode? Maybe not. Over Negronis, both Ava and Monica are projecting sexual energy. Monica hopes the cast on Ava's arm is from a sports injury since she loves jocks, Kelly adding that Monica dated Dean Cain at Princeton. When Deborah makes a casually mean joke about Ava's clumsiness, Ava jokes that Deborah gets grumpy whenever her left hand is out of commission. When Kelly asks how they met, Ava obliges with the story, clip five.
We were actually set up by our mutual friend Jimmy, who just knew we would hit it off. And we actually met for the first time at Deborah's house, because obviously we needed to keep it very hush-hush, very discreet. And yeah, she hated me. Doc Martens, no makeup, always talking about transit and public housing. And, you know, we just kind of went back and forth, back and forth. The connection was undeniable. But I think our spark is in our fighting that would be bigger. It comes into play in the bedroom a lot, too, as well. Isn't that right, Deb? Anyway, we were fighting like dogs. And I just left. I up and left. And she came chasing after me. I was halfway down her driveway in my car, and she cut me off in her Rolls Royce and insisted that I stay. And so I did. I mean, how could I refuse?
Ooh, hot.
We've been together ever since. Doesn't it just feel like yesterday, Deb?
Yeah, sweetie. Sometimes it feels like 100 years.
Aw.
Ava tells Deborah to give her a kiss and responds to the dry peck Deborah gives her by saying she wasn't so shy on the drive up. How much Deborah wants that pantsuit is evident in how convincing their next kiss is, but her multiple attempts to introduce said pantsuit into the conversation are stymied by more sex talk. Clip six.
Deborah, do you strap?
Strap?
Oh, leave my pillow princess alone.
No.
Oh, really?
Ooh.
Yeah.
Really?
Deb.
Interesting.
I'm particular about my pillows, yes. I'm a Cortina soft down kind of girl.
What?
She's joking. Obviously, Deborah knows that a pillow princess is someone who only likes to receive pleasure during sex.
That is not true. No, I do plenty in bed.
Oh.
You know, lesbionically. No, this is the lazy one.
Oh, yeah. I'm the lazy one. No, you're right. She does love eating my ass. Oh, I'm always looking behind me going, quit chowing down on that thing. It ain't groceries.
Tell me more.
Oh, yeah. We've been doing shibari. That's rope play. So yeah. She'll kind of tie me up and hang me from the damn ceiling like a chandelier.
We know Sia.
Monica, having revealed that she and Kelly are open and noted Ava's quite obvious sexual interest in her, nearly leads to a kiss over strawberries and creme fraiche in the kitchen until Deborah walks in on them, touching off a screaming fight back in Deborah and Ava's suite. Clip 7.
How dare you cheat on me?
I am not cheating on you because we are not in a relationship. It's a lie, which is your specialty.
Well, if you fuck that nympho trophy wife and Kelly finds out, I won't ever get that jumpsuit.
That's not true because Kelly and Monica are open.
Well, we are monogamous.
What?
That's what works for me.
Is everything all right in here?
Oh, everything's fine.
Ava? Are you okay? You know, when you're in a relationship with an older, more powerful woman, it's hard to find your voice.
She is my voice.
Deborah, calm down. Ava, sweetheart, how'd you really break your arm? A driverless car with no witnesses, it seems convenient.
Oh, my God! I never hit her! Well, I didn't this time!
I'm just gonna say it because I don't think Ava feels safe saying it. But Deborah, Ava wants to be ethically non-monogamous with you.
No, she doesn't. Well, yes, I do, but that's not what this is about.
All right, so Ava, what is this about?
Well, I'm upset because Deborah is clearly keeping something from me, and it hurts my feelings that she cannot be honest with me.
Yeah, well, everything hurts your feelings.
Yeah, hurtful things hurt my feelings, Deborah. Sue me.
I have!
The next day, Ava and Deborah make up, and Deborah agrees to confess to their host, which doesn't go the way Deborah or Ava expected. Clip 8.
Wow. Anyway, I am so sorry I lied.
Wow.
I respect your culture.
Deb, after a full weekend of watching you and Ava, I think it is pretty obvious that you're in a relationship.
It's just so sad that you cannot live your full truth.
Let's get at least one thing out of the closet this weekend. You can have the fucking jumpsuit.
Oh.
But I'm not gonna play this game with you. Follow me upstairs to the closet, get it, and out.
Yes, ma'am. Ms.
If a segment of the viewership wants to agree with Kelly and believe that makeout between Ava and Deborah was on some level proof of carnal feelings in both directions, they can. It's a lovely gift for the show to give fans in its last moments. And for everyone else, number 3, it takes Deborah and Ava's connection seriously. Even though fictional stories tend to treat romance as the pinnacle of human relationships, what Hacks has beautifully shown over its run is that platonic relationships can be just as meaningful and maybe more so. At this stage in the show's run, it feels safe to say what Deborah and Ava have is almost past what we have words for, encompassing their links as friends, professional partners, and even close to adoptive mother and child. Last of these comes into play around Deborah's mysterious doctor visit and Ava's anxiety around her secrecy. The advice Kelly gives Ava about the fraudulent relationship ends up being relevant, and Ava's response is touchingly vulnerable. Clip 9.
It seems to me that Deborah has probably betrayed you in the past, and maybe the truth is that you're just not fully over it. And I think that maybe you might be trying to heal that betrayal by oversharing incredibly intimate, graphic details about your relationship and demanding to know everything about Deborah's life.
Yeah, you might be right.
Well, sometimes oversharing is a means of forcing intimacy because you're afraid the other person will withhold it from you.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I do share too much. I don't know, I just wish that she wouldn't keep so many walls up after all this time.
The people we love oftentimes are fundamentally different than us. And for someone like Deborah, letting her guard down, that gives her the opposite feeling of safety. Oh, it's just different strokes, you know?
Yeah.
Ava finds Deborah after that, and Deborah finally admits there was a mass. She didn't want to tell Ava until after her procedure because she knew Ava would freak out. And she shows Ava a doctor's email giving Deborah a clean bill of health. At this point, we don't even know whether Deborah has given this much information about her health to her daughter, DJ. That Ava and Deborah could be having sex is the episode's joke. Their actual intimacy is not. And number 4, Kayla isn't in this episode. So in conclusion, from Shibari to the relative fanciness of Tate's cookies to Seabird's wistful goodbye, lyrics including, there's a road I know I must go, even though I tell myself that road is closed. Montecito has something for everyone. Vote it in before I have to run into your bedroom in the dead of night with a bat screaming that I'm in DSA.
Thank you, Tara. Caroline, why don't you take first crack at this one?
I mean, first of all, incredible argument for, well done, Tara. And to make me laugh at Kayla's not in it, I did not know about your strong anti-Kayla feelings until this moment, but now I do, and I get it. When I first saw this as a possibility for the canon, I will admit that my first reaction was that I don't know if that's the one I would have chosen from the last season. I watched the final season pretty quickly, kind of inhaled it, and was so blown away by the final episode, which I'm not going to get into here, but it would have been hard for me to resist picking that. But then I rewatched it and I was like, no, this is really solid. And I really like your arguments for it from a sitcom perspective. The sort of farce of it is really funny. And the balancing act that they have to do here between placating fans who are rooting for this to become sexual, of which there are indeed, I can confirm, very many, and they're allowed. And also staying true to their characters because, you know, frankly, in my professional opinion, Deborah is as straight as they come. But, and it says a lot, like you said, about how much she wants this jumpsuit, that she's willing to do this. So there's a fine line between placating those fans and also, you know, making them feel like they're being mocked. And I feel like this episode walks a very fine line there and does a really good job of not making a mockery of that feeling because, mm-hmm. like you said, their intimacy is so strong. They very easily, if they were both feeling it at some time, it would make sense. Right. So to kind of play that out in this way, in this farce way, is really clever. Cherry Jones and Leslie Bibb are incredibly good in it. And it does also move the story along towards where the season and the series ultimately go.
Yep.
In a way that I think is very smart and also is an evolution of their relationship, which over the last four seasons, you know, they're fighting, they're making up, they're fighting. And this final season is the first where they never are fighting for more than half an episode. So by the end of the episode, it's resolved. And that to me was refreshing because I was quite sick of the going back and forth. I was like, you're going to find your way back together. Let's be done with this. Yeah. And the show was by this point. There are lots of very incredibly specific queer jokes in this, which I really enjoyed as someone within that community. My parents actually coincidentally just watched this episode a couple nights ago, and they loved it, and they had no idea what any of those jokes were. So that, to me, really made me feel, okay, this probably is canon-worthy. I came away from my second viewing more impressed with it than I even was the first time, I would say.
Sarah D. Bunting, what do you think about this one?
Excellent presentation. I was thinking, not while I was watching the episode, but during your presentation, about this movie from 10 or 12 years ago called Life Partners. And it was Leighton Meester and Gillian Jacobs as friends. One is gay, one is not. And how they're sort of trying to renegotiate or thinking they need to renegotiate their best friendship when Gillian Jacobs is getting married, marrying a guy, but that's not really the point. The point is, like, how do you sort of figure out where everyone in your found family lives in the rooms of your heart and all that stuff? It was not a perfect movie, but very charming. And what I liked the most about it, nobody ever talks about it anymore. I may be the only one who wasn't in it that saw it.
Oh, no. It's very important in my household as well.
Oh, excellent. I'm so glad to hear that someone else saw it. We could be life partners. I just liked that it just took seriously grown women's relationships with each other and didn't make it about, like, competition or have to drive it towards romance. There was, like, a respect for the different ways that adult relationships and sort of intimate, vulnerable relationships can be and still be platonic. But it was also extremely funny. And Cherry Jones was so, like, wonderful, sort of, you know, we've done a lot of couples, like, haha. Yes. But then she's, like, using what she learned and telling Ava about it. And I just thought that was a really nice performance from Cherry Jones, who I always love. And, you know, this was like maybe a Ellen DeGeneres rep clawback that Ellen herself did not earn, but congrats for it. Got it anyway. The great Leslie Bibb, just completely unvain. As always, like, the first time she appears, she's in, like, a beekeeper outfit. There's a whole gag about, like, is your chicken coop a euphemism? Like, no, it's actual chickens. And of course, the great Jean Smart, like, that absolute leaving her body stare into the middle distance when ass eating comes up, that she's just like, you can hear internal flames crackling and preparing to go up the side of her face. It's so good. But it's also the bones of the sitcom sort of hold up or surround the heart of this, which is a relationship that doesn't necessarily have any labels, like Deborah says at some point, protesting too much, but also life is a little messier than fits in a TV show sometimes, but this episode got it to fit in there and was still extremely funny at the same time. Excellent work all around, including you, T-Bone, my non-carnal life partner. Dave.
Yeah, just picking up from something Caroline said in relation to Tara's argument, when you're walking that line between doing something that is sort of fan service, but being careful not to mock them in the moment, the great thing about this episode, speaking to what Tara said, is that so many things are doing double duty here or are stacked upon each other, where all those moments are grounded because they're where they're talking about a romantic relationship and they are talking about their friendship. So I thought that was very clever way to get into that discussion without feeling like it's mocking you because it's actually not happening. You know, there's truth to everything they say in those moments. I just have a few things. I'm really glad you mentioned the DSA bat moment at right at the end there, because that was my favorite laugh out loud moment. And I didn't catch it the first time we watched it.
I didn't either.
Because she is screaming. The scene at the beginning is Deborah waking up from her terror sweat dream. Ava running in with a bat. What's going on? What's going on? And before she knows, I got a bat and I'm in the DSA, which I'm like, all right, well, that one was just for Tara, I guess.
Well, she explains it's because she thinks the proletariat is rising up, and she wanted to see how things were going before she picked a side.
So funny.
Just some other random moments, since everybody covered everything else. Well, what actually do you do if you get hit by a self-driving car and then it just drives away? Like, what is your recourse besides just going to the urgent care to get a sling?
I assume they have cameras, right? You can probably, after the fact... That's what
they
I'm saying.
They have license plates.
Yeah. At least get your boba paid for. Jeez.
Well, that was the other thing. At the so end funny. Of that, yes, the absolutely sad, defeated reading of my boba. Really great. Deborah Vance's kitchen has a soda machine with...
I know!
Three of which are Coca-Cola products. We have Coke Classic, Diet Coke, and Coke Zero, which means we know she's a really good host because you have all your Coke options there.
So. I was wondering, looking at it, because the soda machine has come up before, but only in terms of Diet Coke. And I'm like, do they all do Diet Coke? Or Deborah Vance is not drinking Sunkist. That's DJ.
No, but she has guests. Mm-hmm. Yes, that's DJ for sure. We did talk about this when we rewatched the episode this weekend. And I was saying, I'm surprised there is no Fresca, because that feels like a very
Honestly,
Deborah kind of drink.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Fresca, straight from the tap. I've never had such luxury. That's a beautiful use of money, that soda machine. That's the thing I'm the most jealous of.
The closest we could come was after they showed in the first season, you could see her like red Pizza Hut plastic cups. Yeah. And we did get some of those.
Although not the gigantic affront to God size that we got earlier this year, which is like...
Ours hold two full cans of soda.
Like 4-liter cup somehow.
They're big.
Paying the psychic in salami is something somebody did, which made me laugh at the moment. Mm-hmm. Just absolute nonsense. And I am team Ava with Tate's or fancy cookies. I'm not a fancy person, but for me, Tate's are like a fancy cookie.
Jump off the Tate's moment. It does feel like, you know, there's a little bit of a reset in the car when they're going back. You know, they kind of get back into their regular dynamic. Something I really enjoy about this episode is how, like, the dynamic does flip because Deb is so out of her element and Ava knows it. And every little bit of, like, you know, sexual, you know, lingo she's using is because she's like, Deb has no idea what she's doing here. The pillow princess thing, the, you know, the strap reference that she has no idea what it means. And it's fun to watch that flip and watch Deb be completely out of her element. And also, any joke she makes is a hack lesbian joke, like she would have made on the cruise. But so it made me think of the lesbian cruise episode a lot, which I think was season two. And watching her revert back to hack jokes when she's uncomfortable was very interesting and exactly what would happen. But I do feel like if you watch the Lesbian Cruise episode and then you watch this one, like, what a beautiful encapsulation of where that relationship has come over the past few years. It's a really interesting bookend in that way.
Yeah,
I can't believe I got into that through Tate's, but it did jog something.
That's the miracle of a fancy cookie. All right, let's put this to the vote. Caroline, what do you say about this? Canon worthy or not?
Gay rights, yes.
All right, Sarah DeBundy?
Not a euphemism, yes.
Yes, me too. So... That means The Hack, Season 5, Episode 7, Montecito, you are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
All right, let's make this quick. Winner and loser of the week time. Tara has this week's winner.
Yeah, periodically there'll be a hit will pop off on the streaming charts that was something that nobody knew or cared about when it was actually airing on television. And we got a new one, and it's La Brea, which just went to Netflix and is at the top of the streaming charts somehow. And granted, we only watched the premiere. Maybe it got much better after that. I doubt it, but...
I have a theory.
Yes.
Remember Suits LA? When the Suits yes. thing popped up? Mm-hmm. They are trying to engineer a crossover where Suits LA people fall into the La Brea pit, time travel, dinosaur hole, and then have to deal with all that.
That I would watch.
Yeah, me too. Mm-hmm. And loser of the week, Sarah D. Bunting.
The executives who did not buy Matthew Rhys and Dave Annable's pitch for a brothers and sisters holiday special? Come on. It's not like neither of them has any suction right now between Widow's Bay and I don't know if Dave Annable is on one of the 16 yellow pebbles in life right now. But I mean, I just think that's a good idea. That is sort of a fondly remembered show. Everyone involved is, I think, still okay and not mm-hmm. canceled. And, you know, Gidget's not getting any younger. Let's get this done.
Well, speaking about getting it done, do you know what time it is?
It's Gidget time.
It's Gidget time. Welcome, everybody, to Game Time. Before we get into the festivities today, I have a call to action. If you've ever tried to create a Game Time, you're like, I really like this concept, but I can't stretch it out to 24 questions or whatever, then I am making a call to submit those, and I'm going to collect them all, and we're going to do some sort of Game Time decathlon, where we're going to take all these high-concept, low-yield ideas, stick them all together, and I can tell you whose questions are going to be in that set for sure. It is Mr. Dan Cassino, who authored today's game, and for time, we have to cut a few questions, so I'm going to take them, and they're now top of the queue for our decathlon. But let's get into it. This is the third Game Time of the season. The scores are currently Tara with one, Value Guess with one, Sarah looking to get on the board today. Today we are playing Thou Shalt Guess the Title, Book 2. It does come from Dan Cassino.
Damn you, Cassino!
Who earns himself an extra credit and a free shirt from our store at throughmethods.com. Dan writes, I understand that there were some questions, concerns, and threats about the previous game about family-friendly streaming services, and I've taken them into account with this new one. Now, rather than guessing the name of a show from the description, I'm going to give you the name, and you have to guess what the show is about from three options that I, David T. Cole, will read to you.
Okay.
If the current player guesses, but you still think the correct answer is on the table, it is at this point you can use your steel mill by yelling steel meal, and then before I give the answer, say what the unused option that you think is the real answer is. So in theory, we could have all three people in on one question.
Oh, wow.
There are three options, but also there is a Dan made this up option for every show. So you have to pick through three options or Dan made it up.
Right.
All right. These shows are mostly, but not exclusively, produced by these platforms. Some of these may have had previous runs elsewhere. Let's figure out the steel meal situation, please, Tara.
Thank you, Dave. Sarah has three. I have seven. Valued guests have one plus Eric's point for a total of two.
All right. So use them up, Caroline, because they just go bad after this episode. Oh, yes. All right. Let's throw it to Piggy to see who our first guesser will be.
We will start with Tara.
All right. Tara, Sarah, and then Caroline is our order. Are we ready to play?
Yes, sir.
Bless your heart.
Tara, the show is called Relative Race. It has 151 episodes on BYU TV, Brigham Young University Television.
Yes.
Here are your options. Option A, Tara, DNA testing means that some of the strangers competing on this road trip competition show are related, and they have to figure out who's their long-lost relation while winning low-stake challenges. Mm-hmm. Option A. Option B, four teams embark on a cross-country road trip that's legally distinct from other, more amazing races as they seek out long-lost members of their family. Or is it C, four traditional families are shuffled across four teams to compete in a challenge-filled road race that runs from Canada to Mexico? Or did Dan just make that all up? A, B, C, or D? Those are your choices. Relative race.
I'm going to say it's B.
All right.
Four teams embark on a cross-country road trip that's legally distinct from other more amazing races as they seek out long-lost members of their family.
Okay. Anybody want to put in a steel meal challenge there? Everybody not feeling confident there. I can tell you that relative race is B. Yes.
Hey!
Cross-country road trip.
Wow.
Nicely done. That is worth a point. Sarah D. Bunting.
Yes.
Shadrach. Shadrach.
Shadrach.
Yeah.
S-H-A-D-R-A-C-H.
Yeah, Shadrach. As in from the Bible. That guy.
Yep. Shadrach.
Six episodes on Great American Pure Flix. Is it A, man's faith is put to the test in a near future where faith is outlawed? Will he follow his friend Daniel to certain death or renounce Jesus? Or is it B, moving from the city to the country is hard for 12-year-old Anna until she takes a shortcut from home and meets a horse who changes her life? Or is it C, period piece in which a former slave fights for the right to be buried on the land in which he worked as an enslaved man? Or did Dan make it up?
Oh my God. These are like all over the place. Well, I can't say I'm happy about it, but I'm going to say C, period piece.
Everybody's nodding. I don't feel a challenge coming on this one. Shadrach is about Anna and her horse that she meets.
Oh, that was my second
path.
Choice.
Amazing.
I mean, I was going to steel meal see if you didn't do it, because that's a wild thing to make up to.
Yeah.
I guess it must be another show.
Caroline, you get to guess first here. It is called Playing for Eternity. It had 23 episodes on Angel, everybody's favorite network. Is it an animated series about biblical characters competing in various games in heaven? A dramedy about a group of homeschool kids who start a sports team and have to compete with seculars.
Ugh.
Or seculars. C, legendary athletes like Alvin Davis, Sam Wuching, and Daryl Strawberry leave stories about how their faith led them to success in sports.
I am going to go with C. I'm going to go with the sports.
All right, sports. Everybody thinks there was a lot of detail on that for it not to be real, and I'm telling you, you are correct. It was C.
Hey, good job.
All right, Tara.
Yeah.
You've got County Rescue.
Mm.
11 episodes up on that Great American Family Network we all love.
Sounds great.
Is it A, inspirational documentary reality show about the workers at the county pound in Box Elder County, Utah?
Mm-hmm.
Or B, reality show following rescue squads in Provo with narration by Mr. William Shatner?
Mm-hmm.
Or C, romantic drama in which a young woman must overcome her recent heartbreak to compete with two eligible young men for a job as a paramedic? Or Dan made it up?
That's so detailed and crazy that it makes me think that might be it. But I'm actually going to go with A, inspirational documentary about workers at a county pound in Utah.
Okay.
Steel meal.
Steel meal from Sarah D. Bunting. What are you going to go for?
I think it's C.
She thinks it's C. Caroline's staying out of this one. I can tell you that Sarah D. Bunting just picked up the point.
Oh,
it
God.
Is C. Romantic
job,
drama,
Sarah.
Paramedic show. There we go.
Wow.
All right. Sarah, are you ready for yours? We're talking Sugar Creek Amish Mysteries. And why wouldn't we? Six episodes on Up, Faith, and Family. I don't know if that's two separate things or one. Who knows?
I think it's Up, Faith, and Family.
Okay. Is it A, bereft Chicago woman repairs to a Mennonite community where she runs her aunt's gift shop and solves low-stake mysteries? Mm-hmm. B, when her mother dies, a secular young woman returns to her religious hometown and is hired as the local police liaison? Or C, a young woman joins her local quilting circle and helps them solve mysteries? Or D, Dan made it up.
D.
D.
He made this up.
She thinks
all
Dan made it up. not hearing a challenge. I can tell you that Dan did not make that up.
Oh.
This is a low-stake mystery Mennonite village where she went and took over the Ann's gift shop.
Oh, no. Wow. All right, that sounded so Hallmarky that I was like, no.
Surely it's two on the All nose. Right. No, never two on the nose.
All right, back to Caroline. You've got Random Acts. Random Acts. 91 episodes on good old BYU TV. Is it A group of telegenic teens surprise people who have been noticed for their own selfless acts with unexpected parties?
We.
B, behind the scenes nerves and prep before a film version of the climactic talent show from Utah's leading performance summer camp. Or C, hidden camera show where all the surprises are nice little acts of kindness. Or did Dan just make this all up? Random acts.
I kind of want it to be C, so I'm going to go with C.
Okay, C.
The anti-punked.
Yes.
I can tell you, Random Acts is a hidden camera show where all the surprises are nice little acts of kindness. Nice.
Time to subscribe to BYU TV.
Yep.
Yeah.
Tara.
Yep.
Promised Land, 6 episodes on Angel. Is it A modern ranching family perseveres with love and faith as government agents try to take their land?
Ooh.
I just hate them so much.
Oof.
B,
ouch.
In a comedic reimagining of Exodus.
Already in.
Moses and Aaron try to get those wacky Hebrews through the desert.
Okay. Oh, boy.
C, inspiring drama about Mormon settlers making their way to Utah. Or D, did Dan just make all this up? Promised Land.
I don't know if there's a lot of Mormon content on non-Mormon networks, but then again, I also don't know if Angel is a Mormon network. How many networks do they need?
Ranching, yeah. Exodus, Mormon settlers.
I'm gonna go with D. Dan made this up.
Anybody want to put in a little steal? Nope. All right. I can tell you that this is a comedic reimagining of Exodus.
Oh,
so glad I didn't spend my steal bill.
Here's what's gonna happen. We're gonna get to the end of this and find out Dan did not make any of these up.
That's where this is going. And if so, respect, sir.
Yes.
Sarah D. Bunting. You've got Fun Dementals. That's with capitals on fun. 10 episodes on Great American Pure Fix. Pure Flix, excuse me. Although you can get a pure fix if you just open your heart.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
A small angel and his family have adventures exploring the crystal dome surrounding creation.
Sure, obviously.
B, adventures of a Christian youth band spreading fun and gospel across the United States.
I'm listening.
C, hybrid human puppet science program educating kids about how the literal word of the King James Bible is the only source of truth. Or D, did Dan make this up? Fundamentals.
Oh my God.
Yes.
These all smack of they'll never believe this shit casino-wising, but that's it. I am going to answer that it is A, Small Angel and Crystal Dome.
All right, Small Angel and Crystal Dome. I hear no challenges.
Steel meal.
Caroline.
I would say C.
C, hybrid human puppet science show.
You know what? What the hell? I'm going to say B.
All right, A, meal. B, and C. Nicely done. Uh-oh. Steel meal's wasted. Dan made it up.
No!
That's the funniest outcome.
Could not script that better, guys.
I should have gone with my first instinct. Why?
All right, this will take us into our score break. It is for Caroline.
Dan, you sicko.
It is called Vindication, 36 episodes on Redeem TV. Is it A faith-based crime drama following the small-town investigative adventures of Detective Gary Travis? Or B, ex-con Travis Gary walks the earth doing good works to make up for the mild crimes we see in flashbacks while searching for his lost daughter? Or C, a faith-based take on The Fugitive as wrongly accused minister Peter Simons must constantly choose between revealing his identity and helping those in need? And of course, Dan made this up. A, B, C, or D? What are you thinking here? Vindication.
Well, I don't trust Dan anymore. Yep. That's for sure.
That's the way it works.
Mild crimes we see in flat. I'm going to go with B just because what's a mild? All right. Yeah, we'll go with B.
All right. Making up for mild crimes. Yeah. Sort of my name is
parking
Ezekiel.
Tickets?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. My name is Travis.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I can tell you that the answer was A, faith-based crime drama.
Shit, I would have said C.
With the detective.
I wasn't confident, though.
All right. Mm. It is time for the scores. We are halfway done.
Well, I have us with a very tight race. Sarah and I are tied with 1 point each. Caroline has two.
All right, we're back into it. This one is for Tara.
Yes.
The show is called Seabiscuit.
Okay.
It has 10 episodes on Great American Family. Is it about A 12-year-old girl growing up on a horse ranch in New Mexico discovers that one of their horses is descended from a champion? Can she train him to become a winner and save the family ranch from foreclosure? Or B, animated series about a seahorse training to be the next great racing champion with the help of a 12-year-old mermaid? Or C, period drama set at a Depression-era racetrack. Can the love of a 12-year-old girl turn a horse with a broken leg into a champion? Or the possibility that Seabiscuit was made up by Dan?
I'm going to go with B.
Animated series about a seahorse training to be the next champion with the help of a mermaid.
Yes.
Steel meal.
Steel meal from Sarah D. Bunting.
Some of these are close to the Seabiscuit story, but pretty sure this show doesn't exist and Dan made it up, so D.
All right. Caroline's staying out of it. I can tell you
that, again.
That Sarah D. Bunting is using her steel meals pretty well. She's batting 666, I think, so far. Because Dan made that
Well done, Sarah.
Helps to be a horse girl.
Well spotted.
Thank you very much.
All right, Sarah, here is yours.
Yeah.
We're talking about Mallory Towers. 103 episodes available for streaming on Brigham Young University TV. Is it A, book adaptation about young women in an exclusive boarding school in the British countryside in the 50s? B, inspirational drama about a young woman who inherits an apartment building and uses it to house people in need of a second chance? Or C, an inspirational romantic drama about the diverse group of women training to be nurses in London at the start of World War II and the men they help to recover? Or did Dan make this up? Mallory Towers.
I'm not nearly as confident about this one. I mean, why would all these Brits be on BYU TV? But then again, why wouldn't they? Okay, fuck it. You gotta do something. I'm gonna do B.
Inspirational drama about a woman who inherits an apartment building. Anybody want to challenge that? Not feeling it. All right, mm-mm. Sarah D. Bunting, you are incorrect. It was with the British people. This was the boarding school in the British countryside of the 1950s.
That was my last choice, so what can you do? Except rain curses down upon the head of Casino.
All right, buckle in, Caroline. We've got homeschooled for you. Homeschooled, so you know it's going to be a corker. 10 episodes on Great American Pure Flicks. Is this homeschooled about A girl assigned to an unconventional foster home where she lives with 7 multi-ethnic kids, all being homeschooled by Christian fundamentalist parents.
Ew.
Brackets, yay. B, a self-centered businesswoman discovers that she has inherited 5 sheltered homeschooled kids who have grown up in the Midwest. C, after some scary moments at their school, a mom and dad decide to quit their jobs and move to a horse ranch where they will homeschool all 6 of their kids. Or did Dan make homeschooled up? Those are your options, Caroline. Good luck.
I wish I could say Dan made this up, but I have a feeling he didn't. And I'm going to choose the one that makes me the most uncomfortable, which is A, a girl assigned to an unconventional foster home.
Yeah. I like your thought process.
Yes, I like the way you think.
All right, so it sounds like nobody's going to challenge that? All right. It was indeed not that. It was B, self-centered businesswoman discovers she has inherited 5 homeschooled kids.
Oh, I hate those self-centered
isn't basically the plot of Rags to Riches, though?
He doesn't inherit them. He adopts them for PR,
okay,
I think.
Well,
it's been a while.
Oh, well, that one's also horrifying. So, you know,
it is.
Yeah. All
fine. Tara.
They're all bad.
Yep.
These stones. These stones. 6 episodes on Up. Family and Faith, or Up Faith and Family, or Up Faith and Family.
Yep.
Is it A? Yep, move on. Is it A bereft young woman finds herself working in a program that pairs troubled people with relevant undercover Bible characters?
Okay. Jesus.
All right. B, Amanda inherits a box of magical stones with ambiguous Bible phrases written on them and has to distribute them to the people who need them.
Yeah.
Couldn't get through that one. C, a woman encounters standing stones that let her travel back in time to help her persecuted ancestors. Or did Dan make these stones? These stones up.
D. Dan made them up.
She thinks Dan made it up. Anybody want to challenge that? No.
Mm-mm.
These Stones is about a bereft young woman finding herself working in a program that pairs troubled people with undercover Bible characters.
Six episodes is plenty of that shit.
My God. All right, Sarah, you've got Dr. Wonder's Workshop.
Oh, Christ.
64 episodes available on Redeem TV. A creationist science show ostensibly about the wonders of nature featuring dinosaur puppets and set in the Ark Encounter Museum in Kentucky. Tara, shout out to us.
Shout out. We went there.
One-time visitors.
They have some of our money.
B, a kid's show about a prop comic and magician, as well as the diverse group of kids and puppets that help him test out his wacky inventions. Or is it C, a kid's show in which a combination of puppets and deaf actors work together on fanciful new inventions? Or D, Dan made Dr. Wonder's Workshop up.
Boy, I can only rule out one. And while I would like it to, I would like C to exist, but I feel like this is A.
All right, so you think this is a science show set in the Ark Encounter Museum. I would love to see it. But unfortunately, that is not the answer. This is a kid's show in which a combination of puppets and deaf actors work together.
Well, you know what? I'm glad that at least that exists.
Yep. All right. Got to call an audible here and end this after 15 because we are running long. But we'll use the rest of the quiz. Do not worry. So I need the scores here. We only have one question left for Caroline. Here we go.
Okay, I have 1 point. Sarah and Caroline are tied with 2.
Ooh, okay. So with a correct answer here, and keep in mind, anybody can get that answer. It's all on the line. Here we go. Caroline, you've got Theodosia. 52 episodes on Brigham Young University Television. Is it about a turn-of-the-century girl obsessed with Egyptology conveniently gets a magic amulet that helps her fight against ancient Egyptian magic? Or is it B, an animated series about a young woman in ancient Rome whose family has recently converted to Christianity but must keep the religion a secret? Or is it C, period drama about Aaron Burr's daughter as she tries to balance her desire to be an independent woman with her own romantic interests and the need to support her aging father? Or did Dan make it up, as always?
Or did Dan make it up? Okay.
Theodosia.
I feel like it's an obvious fake out for C because that's, he knows that the only place I've heard Theodosia before is in Hamilton.
This is good. This is how you play. You got to get into the head of Mr. Dan, Professor Dr. Dan Cassino.
Would it help if Dave read all of C in the Got Milk Amber Daughter voice?
There it is.
It would help me.
You know, I'm going to say, I think B, but I'm going to go for broke and say A because that sounds like a lot more fun with a magic amulet.
Okay. Turn of the century girl obsessed with Egyptology must fight against Egyptian magic. Anybody want to challenge that?
Mm-mm.
Nobody's feeling confident. This is it. If it's correct, you've won. If it's not, we got to go to a tiebreaker.
Yeah. You know what? Fuck it.
Wow.
The alternative paper I worked for was in Aaron Burr Hall. So let's say C with that last deal meal. Let's go.
Okay.
All right. We've got A on the board. We've got C on the board. C, Aaron Burr. A, Egyptology. I can tell you, we have a winner.
Good luck.
And it is our value guest. It is about a girl obsessed with Egyptology. Nicely done.
I think I would have loved that one as a kid.
How would you have 52 episodes of Theodosia? That was a mistake on my part. But congratulations, Caroline.
Thank you so much. It does sound like something I would have watched in the 90s.
Yep.
Constantly.
Thank you, Dan. We'll keep the rest of the quiz for next time.
You're a sick man, Dan.
Valued guest.
Valued guest.
That only makes him stronger.
It's really true. All right, guys, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We hit the road with the Vampire Lestat before going around the dial with stops at Not Suitable for Work, Love Island, UK, and Michael Jackson, The Verdict. Tara made out with her cannon pitch for Hack's Montecito episode. Yes, thank you. I was very proud of that. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and our value guest, Caroline, was the winner of this week's Game Time from Mr. Dr. Professor Dan Cassino. Next up is Crashers on Extra, Extra Hot Great. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano.
I hate when we go to bed angry.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Oh, yeah. How was jail?
And Caroline Framke.
I have been dumped from the island.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
Well, it's nice to hear from you. You good?
Not really. Bye.
Okay.
Nice.